Paratooth Radio is a proud member of Evergreen Podcasts on killerpodcasts.com.
Christian and non-Christian paranormal investigators. They have two different views, and it seems as if neither of them can ever agree on anything. So what happens when a mainstream view of the paranormal crosses paths with the Christian view? Something.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Paratooth Radio. My name is Eric.
And I'm Justin.
And today we have on another guest. His name is Richard Freeman. He's a full-time cryptozoologist, and he searches for and writes about unknown animals. He has hunted for creatures such as the Yeti, the Mongolian deathworm, the giant anaconda, and many more. He is a zoological director at the Center for 14 Zoology, the world's only full-time mystery animal research organization, which is based in North Devon. He has written numerous books about cryptozoology, folklore, and monsters, including Dragons, More Than a Myth, Explore Dragons, The Great Yukai Encyclopedia, An A to Z of Japanese Monsters, and Yorang Pendek, Sumatra's Forgotten Ape. Today, he is joining us to discuss his book, In Search of Real Monsters. So without further ado, let's go to the line with Richard Freeman. Richard, welcome to Paratooth Radio. How are you?
Fine. And how are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us tonight. We're really excited to talk to you about this.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're having you on to discuss your book, In Search of Real Monsters. One thing that I want you to do for us first and foremost is just kind of define cryptozoology, because I think a lot of people, when they think of cryptozoology, they're simply thinking of things like the Yeti or the Chupacabra, creatures like that. They don't think of real animals that have previously existed. So what exactly is cryptozoology?
It comes from the Latin cryptos, meaning hidden, in zoology. So it's literally hidden zoology. It's the science of unknown animals, and these fall into several categories. They can be things that are completely unknown to science, like the Yeti or a sea serpent. There can be things that were known to science and are assumed to be extinct but might still be around, such as the Tasmanian wolf and the giant ground sloth. And there are known animals that have grown far, far larger than the textbooks or the so-called experts say that they should, like giant crocodiles, giant anacondas, giant squid, and so forth.
All right. So, in your opinion, and I've thought about this all day, what is the most common misconception about cryptids or cryptozoology that people have?
Two things is that it deals with myths, mythological animals like centaurs and griffins and things, which it doesn't. And that all sorts of things get dumped in with cryptozoology that don't belong there, like the chupacabra, which is essentially a media creation, Slender Man, which is completely made up, things like supposed extraterrestrials and all kinds of odd bogeymen, when strictly speaking, cryptozoology is about unknown animals. It's a branch of zoology.
Okay. Now, your interest in cryptozoology and just these animals extends back many years. What was it that really got you interested in monsters?
I can answer that question in three words.
Okay.
Classic Doctor Who.
Okay.
I grew up in the 1970s. Now, we're talking about real Doctor Who. Doctor Who started way back in 1963. It's the longest running science fiction serial in the world and the most successful. So we're talking about the real Doctor Who, not the gender-flipped, woke, PC garbage that the BBC is currently vomiting up and telling us it is Doctor Who, and costing them 60% of their viewers in doing so, in their box-ticking endeavours. I'm talking about the real Doctor Who of the 60s and 70s, when it was dark and frightening and weird. A lot of it was set on Earth in the 70s with the great John Pertwee, and it was at least as much about horror than it was about science fiction. So it was much darker and more frightening than, say, Star Trek. And much more immediate, because these things were happening on your doorstep in the story. So you had stories about giant glowing maggots that crawl out of slag heaps in Wales, and intelligent humanoid dinosaurs that wake up after millions of years of hibernation and find that this upstart mammal has bred like a plague over their planet and then start to wipe them out. You get alien intelligences that animate plastic so they can go into shop room dummies that can jerk into life and attack people and children's toys. And it was really, really disturbing. They had giant rats gnawing people's legs off down Victorian sewers, and it was fascinating. Everything that that the PC crowd would loathe, and everything that I loved. It was like Hammer horror. It was absolutely great, and this got me fascinated with monsters and strange creatures. And I also grew up watching David Attenborough on his wonderful programs like Life on Earth and The World About Us. And it just fascinated me, the idea of unknown animals. And when I left school as a kid, I went into work immediately as a zookeeper. And for many years, I was a zookeeper specializing in reptiles. I looked after crocodiles, alligators, snakes, lizards, tortoises, things like that. And then years later, I stumbled upon this little magazine called Animals and Men, which wasn't as rude as it sounded, which was about cryptozoology. And I started writing for this magazine, and then they asked me to come down and be their zoological director. So I packed up and moved down to the southwest of England and joined the Centre for 14 Zoology, which is an organisation that looks for strange creatures all over the world. And ever since then, I've been to just about every corner of the world looking for bizarre animals.
Awesome. So something that Eric and I have talked about different creatures and even, you know, just reading through the book. Do you think that a lot of the cryptids that we think of today is more so a misidentification compared to the real creature? Because you talk about the thylacine, you talk about the giant sloth and those types of things that are believed to be extinct. But like, for example, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, stuff like that. Is that just misidentification, or is it these creatures are so elusive that we're just not seeing them all the time?
Well, I think the weight of evidence is very much in favour of the Sasquatch and the Yeti being real animals. They're some sort of primate. They're either an unknown species of great ape, or perhaps more likely a relic hominin, a relative of one of the ancestors of man. In 2018, there was a vet called Mark Evans, who took a expedition to Bhutan in search of the Yeti, and he had a geneticist with him called Dr. Eva Bellemain, a French lady, and they took some samples from a lake in the mountains of Bhutan. Well, it was more of a pool than a lake, looking for what's called environmental DNA. That's when an animal passes through an environment and it leaves its cells in the environment, so you can look at what animals have been through by searching for the eDNA. And they were using this in water, because when the animals come to drink, some of the cells come off their skin. And they found that there was a very rare species of enormous wild sheep that they didn't know was in Bhutan that had been drinking from this lake. But they also found the eDNA from a primate. Now, this primate shared something like 99% of its genetic makeup with human beings. So it's more closely related to humans than chimpanzees. Now, there are no apes in Bhutan and no monkeys living up in the mountain. So it wasn't human. What was it? So we think that that could have been the eDNA from a Yeti. Now, I tried to get my hands on this sample and I tracked down Eva Bellemain, and she was very helpful, but she no longer worked for the company that had the sample. They were called SpyGem, which sounds like something out of a James Bond film, a French company. So I got my friend, Christopher Killian, who's a French cryptozoologist, to approach this company. That's a lovely dog, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love dogs. I like them better than I like people. he wrote to them, and they wrote back saying, well, we can't give you this sample, because he wrote saying, look, we want to do more tests on this, because it's not ours to give. It belongs to somebody else. It's not legally ours. So he wrote back again saying, well, who owns it legally, so we can approach them, because we've got scientists in several laboratories that want to run more tests on it. And they wrote back saying the sample has been destroyed. Why have they destroyed that sample?
Right.
That's weird. Well, I mean, so something like the Yeti in this case, we'll just stay on this topic. I wouldn't say it's rare to come across evidence. I mean, I see people constantly posting stuff. Now, whether or not those photos and videos are legit or not is hard to say most times. But you would think that with so much evidence over the years, it wouldn't be so difficult to find a Yeti or a Sasquatch when we go in search of one. So in your opinion, why do you think it's so difficult to find them?
Well, are you familiar with an animal called a snow leopard?
I am, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, in the 1970s, we know snow leopards existed, but nobody had filmed one in a while. So the BBC sent a team out, and I believe the zoologist George Shallow was involved with it. And it took them something like 6 or 7 years to get the first film of a snow leopard in the wild. That's an animal we know exists.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're dealing with something like the Yeti, which is a higher primate, perhaps even a close relative of man, it's a solitary animal. It doesn't live in big groups like gorillas and chimpanzees. It doesn't want to be found. It's going to be terribly, terribly hard to find it in the forests of Bhutan or Tibet or Nepal or anywhere like that. When the Daily Mail sent an expedition in the 50s to look for Yeti, they had hundreds of bearers, and they had horses and pack animals, and they were making a dreadful noise. Their entourage must have been a couple of hundred people, and there was no way they were ever going to get near this animal. So if you're going to find it, you're going to have to spend an awful lot of time in the wild, and you're going to have to go in a small group and be quiet. That's the way to find it.
Okay. Would you consider maybe the intelligence of this creature possibly being, at least in some way, part of the reason that we're having trouble finding it? If it's more understanding of like the people that exist on this earth and what's looking for them, do you think they have more ability of hiding because of that? Whereas like the snow leopard, maybe they don't have the intelligence to simply find an easy way to hide. You know, they just kind of roam around and stay distant until someone snaps a picture. But
well, I think they've survived by avoiding modern man, because they've become mainly nocturnal and they live in these very far away places.
Mm-hmm.
And they're intelligent, they're tool users. We know that they can use tools, they can hurl rocks, they can swing clubs, and apes use tools as well. So they're intelligent animals, or subhumans even. And they've survived through being timid, through avoiding modern man.
So the one creature that I was super excited to see that you had included in this book was the Mongolian death worm. It's a cryptid that Eric and I have talked about, and to be able to talk to somebody who has been to Mongolia to research this is probably the best thing we could hope for, because, you know, you do research online and you find 100 different things and maybe they're not all 100% accurate, but just the fact that you've been able to go and research it is amazing. So when you went to Mongolia to find this, were people really perceptive to you to give you information and that sort of a thing on this creature?
Absolutely, yes. So of all the places I've been, Mongolia is my favorite. It's like walking out onto an alien planet when you're in the Gobi Desert. It is so bizarre and it is so remote. about 1 million people live in Mongolia, but they're mostly in Ulaanbaatar and Ulaanzagad. And when you get out into the Gobi Desert, which is like the size of Western Europe, there's just nobody there. It's complete wilderness. We went for about 3 weeks, for about 1,000 miles through the Gobi, and we talked to about 2 dozen witnesses who were all describing the same thing. A sausage-shaped or cylindrical creature, rather like a draft excluder or a salami in shape, a reddish brown in color, sort of a brick red, a scaly, and most of them said they've just seen it lying there in the sun basking, and it brings with it a great terror. They call it Alroy Huihui, which means intestine worm, because it looks like a length of cow's intestine. They say they're petrified of it. They believe it's poisonous and it can spit a corrosive venom that acts like acid. The electricity, funnily enough, they call that throwing lightning, and they say that that's folklore if it doesn't do that. But they think that it's poisonous and they're terrified of it. And a sighting can throw a whole area into a panic. We talked to one guy who'd seen it when he was a child, when he was tending the camels and goats that his family owned. And he went back and told his parents, and they rounded up all their animals. They packed up the gur, which was this circular tent they had, and moved out of the area. It can throw a whole area into terror. And we talked to people who'd seen it as far back as the 1930s, and one guy who'd seen it just a year before we were there. It seems to be some sort of burrowing reptile rather than a true worm. And my two guesses as to what it is, it's either an amphisbaena, a worm lizard. Amphisbaena's are this weird little group of burrowing reptiles. They're not lizards and they're not snakes. They're in a little group of their own. They're related to both, but they're distinct. They're very strange-looking creatures. If you look at worm lizard online, you'll see, particularly the red worm lizard, looks very like descriptions of the death worm. And then there's this other thing called a sand boa, which are chunky, chubby little snakes, constrictors, but not very big, that live in desert areas. But whatever it is, it's unknown to science. It's a new species. So it's either a new species of amphisbaena or a new species of Sandboa, but it's something new. I think the powers attributed to it are apocryphal, because you'll find this a lot with animals. With gorillas, the natives used to say that they would tear branches off trees and fight elephants with them and carry off native girls to rape them. Of course, they don't do that. And with the Sandboa, there's a type of Sandboa that lives in the Sudan, and the local people call it the apris, and they believe it's so deadly and so poisonous that it doesn't even have to bite you to kill you. You can just touch it and you'll drop down dead. In fact, it's completely harmless.
So what do you think is the main reason that people exaggerate these type of creatures? We see it time and time again, even today and with modern technology, people want to just expand upon what a creature actually is in terms of their ability to destroy or kill. You know, it always has to be dangerous. And I know you covered this a little bit in your book, where everything just has to become, you know, faster, stronger, more deadly for some reason. But why? Why do you think people always gravitate towards that type of description?
I think it's fear of the unknown and fear of something that looks weird. If you're going on your camel through the desert and something slithers out of a sand dune that's as long as your arm and reddish and kind of writhing around, you're going to naturally be wary of it, because there are poisonous snakes in the Gobi. So you're not going to know what it is. You want to leave it alone. With a gorilla, they look big and fierce because they're so strong and muscular, and they have this great brow ridge that gives them a sort of a ferocious appearance, but really they're not at all dangerous unless you provoke them. So it's often an odd or scary appearance.
So in that same story, you talk about a story that you're being told about a woman who saw a dragon in a frozen lake, I believe it was, or a river. And that you feel that dragons are one of those creatures that you absolutely believe are real. And to me, it's super exciting, because as a kid and even today, I'm fascinated with dragons. I do believe either at some point they did exist, or they do exist. They just aren't around where we think they are. But what are your thoughts on why you believe what you believe about dragons?
Dragons are so universal. They're found in every single culture on Earth going back thousands of years. There's a guy called Michael Wetzel who... the name escapes me now. I think it was Michael Wetzel, and he wrote a book called The History of World Mythology, and he traced back dragon legends to about 40,000 years ago in sub-Saharan Africa, and they seem to have spread out from there. What he did was very interesting. He approached folklore and legend as a biologist would approach cladistics. So it shared derivative characteristics. So you can trace certain stories back a long, long way. And some of our favorite fairy tales that we thought started with the Brothers Grimm go much, much back, further back, thousands of years rather than hundreds of years. And he did this with dragons, and we found that they go back at least 40,000 years. And there are a surprising amount of modern day sightings or claims of sightings of dragons from all over the world. And they fall into two categories. One that seems to be some sort of flesh and blood animal, maybe more than one type. And another that seems to be more, want of a better word, paranormal, more spiritual. And I encountered both sorts in Mongolia. This one that was frozen in a river, it was a friend of the man who ran the company he went with, emongol.com, and he said his grandmother had told him that shortly after World War II in northern Mongolia, they'd found a dead dragon frozen in a river up in the mountainous areas of Mongolia where it's very cold. And I thought this is going to turn out to be a sturgeon or something. And he said that they found this creature with a spine sticking up through the frozen river, dead in a river. And they ate it. So it was a harsh winter, and there was enough meat to provide the whole village with food and get them through winter. And I was thinking, yeah, this is going to be a really big sturgeon, because sturgeon can reach 23 feet.
Right.
I've no doubt that some lake monsters are enormous sturgeon. And when I asked how long it was, he said it was 100 feet. So what the hell was it? I just wish they'd have kept some scales or bones or something. But he said that, these were just villagers. They didn't think about the importance of science. And when the summer thaws came, it was all swept away. Now, the other type seems to be something spiritual. And they believe that they're called Dragon Lu, L-U-U. And they're intimately connected with rainfall and water, rather like they are in China and Japan. And they're supposed to come down from the heavens in the clouds, but also live in water. And there's water in the Gobi Desert, but it's underneath the ground. They're supposed to be found in wells and things. And there's this one story we heard of a dragon emerging from a well, And this was back in the time of the socialist period in Mongolia. And these witnesses have said they'd seen this dragon coming up from a well. And members of the local Communist Party heard this and interpreted it as a religious story. So they poured, as punishment, they poured oil down the well to taint the water. Apparently within a week, two of them, the men were dead for no apparent reason. They just dropped down dead. The third one was struck barren and impotent. He couldn't have children, or so the story goes. Now that might just be a story, but I heard another story from the head of a sum center, and a sum is rather like a county in Mongolia. They call them sums, but Mongolia is so vast that a sum can be the size of a small country. And we heard this story from Bulgan Sum, and the guy told us that a doctor was there a few years before, because they have the traveling doctors that go around to the sum centers to attend to people. And he went to draw water from a well, and he said he saw this enormous serpentine creature in the well with a face like a horse or a camel and a great scaly coiled body with limbs on it, all wrapped up in the well. And that was a doctor, an educated man. So we never did get to find him. We never we never heard of the story from the horse's mouth, as it was. It was a secondhand story, but it's fascinating that the belief in these things persists. In West Africa, they tell similar stories as well of this thing in the swamps called the Ninkinanka, which may be a demonization of a pre-Islamic python worship cult. But they talk about this thing with a horse-like face, a great long body, crest on the head, bat-like wings, four legs, a venomous bite that they say that lives in the swamps, and they're terrified of it. They believe that to see it is death. If you see it, you'll die within 5 years. And all sorts of disasters are blamed on this creature. When people go missing in the swamp, when a lorry crashes and people are killed, I believe it's the baleful influence of the Ninkinanka.
Do you think, like, if dragons are real or were real, do you think that any of the evidence that we found, or any of the fossils that we found that we deem as dinosaurs, could actually be mistaken actual dragon fossils? Or why do you think maybe we're not finding fossilized dragons like we would with dinos?
Well, in China, they thought that when a dragon shed its skin and grew and had fresh skin, it also shed its bones and grew new bones, and these bones would fall to the earth and turn to stone. Of course, they were the bones of dinosaurs, and they ground them up and used them in medicine. And there's whole treaties written in China about how to use dragon bones in medicine, and that the yellow ones were more effectual than the black ones, and women should never pick them because they lose their power if a woman collects them, and it has to be men that collects them. I don't think we've found dragon fossils because I think that the dragon, as we think of it, is the bat-winged, four-legged, fire-breathing animal, I think is a paranormal manifestation rather than something of flesh and blood.
Okay.
It could be something interdimensional. It could be some subconscious tulpa, a thought form. It could be any of these things.
Okay.
And you've got to add to that people seeing outsized lizards, outsized snakes, outsized crocodiles, animals they don't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
That would all add to the melange, really, of dragon lore all over the world.
And that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, as you mentioned in the book, there are alligators that get to gargantuan sizes, only specific ones, but. And you talk about giant serpents, giant crocodiles, giant alligators. But in your opinion, out of all the creatures you talk about in the book, do you have a favorite or do you have a all-time favorite cryptid at all?
The Tasmanian wolf is,
okay,
is my favorite because I think it's the most likely to exist. And it's also a great symbol for cryptozoology and conservation. The Center for 14 Zoology, the organization I work with, we have it as our logo. And this is a flesh-eating marsupial. It's a great example of convergent evolution, where two animals, often on opposite sides of the world, completely unrelated, evolved to look like each other because they're fulfilling the same ecological niche or role. And with the case of the Tasmanian wolf, it looks like a wolf or a dog. But in fact, it's a marsupial. Its closest living relative is a little insect-eating marsupial called a numbat. But it's also related to the Tasmanian devil. And of course, it raised its young in a pouch. And if you imagine a sort of a short-haired, wolf-sized dog with a kangaroo's tail and tiger-like stripes on its haunches, you won't go far wrong for visualizing what this animal looks like. Now, it was supposed to have been wiped out by the white settlers in Tasmania because it started killing their sheep when they brought sheep over. And there was a bounty put on it. And for about 100 years or so, it's pretty mercilessly hunted. And then there was a population crash because sarcoptic mange got a hold of the marsupial population in Tasmania. The last one was supposedly one called Benjamin that died in Hobart Zoo in the mid-1930s, 36, I think it was, if I remember correctly. But since that time, there have been over 4,000 sightings, including one by a zoologist and one by a park ranger. And the interesting thing is, there was this scientist called Professor Henry Nix, and he developed a computer program called BioClone, and it was meant as a research tool. And what you would do, you would program everything you knew about a particular geographic area into it, then everything you knew about a certain type of animal that's supposed to live within this area. And it would match up where within this area you should look for this animal because of its preferences. For example, if you wanted to look for white rhinos in Botswana, it would tell you whereabouts to look for white rhinos in Botswana on the basis of their preferences. And as a exercise, he did this with the Tasmanian wolf in Tasmania and found that there was a 98% matchup to where the computer program was predicting they should be if they were still around and where people were reporting them from. This thing called the healthiest extinct animal you'll ever meet. I've been over there 3 times looking for it, and I've spoken to people who have absolutely no axe to grind who've seen this creature, including a government licensed shooter who goes out taking down the feral cats they have over there. Now, he's seen it twice in the wilderness. I talked to another man who ran an arboretum over there, who saw it running along the side of the road. And not only did he and his wife see it and stop their car and watch it, there was another car behind them. So it was a multiple sighting.
I feel like the Tasmanian tiger or wolf has been also one of my favorites. Back in high school, which at this point was many years ago, I did a research project on the Tasmanian wolf. And I remember watching a documentary and seeing the various photographic evidence or slight little video evidence that people had and put up online. And it's always like the things that I saw was always just catching the back end of this creature running into the forest. You're just catching the tail or the hind, and you see those really crisp black and white stripes, which is just it's hard to mistake that particular look. But do you think, I don't really know, is this creature, is it one that is more of a pack animal, or do they live pretty solitude lives? And can that make it?
So they lived either solitary or in pairs. They didn't run packs like true wolves. Their lifestyle was more like a coyote than a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
They had a very powerful bite, though, more powerful than a wolf's bite. But the structure of the skull wasn't as well adapted to hold on to struggling prey. Because when wolves hunting in a pack, they'll bite onto things like an animal as large as a bison. And there may be 15, 20 wolves doing this. Mm-hmm. And they'll actually start to eat it while it's still alive. They'll worry it and tear at it. Whereas the Tasmanian wolf, which hunted alone or in pairs, we think it bit with a much more powerful bite and then let the prey bleed to death.
Okay. Well, in that case, I mean, assuming then if they live pretty solitude lives, that just makes it that much more difficult to find them. Because, I mean, you look at modern wolves, you know, even American wolves, the ones that travel in packs, they have a very wide area in which they live, 100 plus miles that they kind of control. A creature like the Tasmanian wolf, did they, at least as far as our research goes, did they have like their own territory, or did they just kind of migrate wherever they needed to go, wherever the food was, water sources?
The thing is, nobody really studied them.
Okay.
At the time, because they were thought of as vermin, so nobody really did proper zoological studies of them until it was too late. So, being a large carnivorous mammal, it was likely that they had territories. There are reports of them from New Guinea as well, where they're called Dobsonga, and they used to live in New Guinea, and New Guinea is one of the most unexplored countries in the world. So it's not impossible that they're surviving there as well. And the natives there, they said, we have this animal called the Dobsonga, comes down from the mountain and kills livestock, and we don't hunt it because it's taboo. But they said it follows where prey animals go. If there are no prey animals in the area, you won't find the Dobsonga. It follows the prey animal.
So you had mentioned earlier about tulpas or thought forms for the fire-breathing dragons. How many cryptids that we talk about today, like you had mentioned the chupacabra, and things like that, Slenderman. How many of cryptids do you think are more Talpa created creatures?
Well, I always say that the paranormal is the last place you should go. Too many people in this field, the first thing they jump on is the paranormal, when it should be the very last thing you come to. Let's get all the more likely explanations out of the way first before you come to that paranormal. Paranormal is an awkward term anyway. It's just something that we don't understand in the way that we didn't used to understand lightning or meteors. But it should be the last thing you go to. So if you're talking about animals that seem to be flesh and blood and make sense, like the orang pendek, for example, or sea serpents, they're likely to be actual real animals we just don't know about. When you're talking about really freakish, bizarre things like the Cornish owl man and the mothman and things like that, then you might be getting into paranormal territory. And I always wrote the owl man off. The owl man, if you don't know what it is, it's a creature not unlike Mothman, but it's been seen for many years around a small area of Cornwall in the southwest of England. And I thought it was sightings of an eagle owl. We have a very rare owl over here. It's common in mainland Europe, and in Britain it's very rare. The eagle owl, it's the biggest owl in the world. It's 6 foot across the wings, and it can take down wild cats and deer. It's a very powerful bird. And I thought people were seeing one of those and just freaking out because it was so big. But I've got a friend who wants to remain anonymous, but he is a very, very well-respected scientist now in a field of natural history. And he's very well known as well. And he's terrified that it will ruin his career if it got out. But when he was a teenager, he and his girlfriend encountered this thing, and he said, no, it's not a needle owl. It's unlike anything I'd ever seen. And he was absolutely terrified of it. He said it had claws on the wings, grey plumage. It didn't have a beak. It had this weird gaping mouth with great glowing eyes. And instead of having talons like a bird, it had pincers like a crab or a lobster, which it held onto the tree with. And it scared him so badly, he had nightmares about it for years. He believed that somehow it had psychically followed him back home from Cornwall to his home, and it was lurking in the woods outside of his house, looking up at him. And both he and his girlfriend kept saying that they saw it in the woods. It was almost like more like a ghost haunting them for months afterwards. And even now, he's in his late 40s, even now he doesn't like talking about it, it still rattles him because it absolutely obliterated his worldview. He's a very, very skeptical, very grounded guy. And to this day, this thing took his worldview out into the backyard and smashed it to pieces with a sledgehammer. And he's never really been able to come to terms with it.
Last question I have, and it's again regarding the paranormal. You said that, you know, sometimes people, especially, it's becoming more common where people are, when they see something that they can't explain, they just jump straight to the paranormal instead of searching for a more reasonable explanation. Do you think that people tend to jump to that paranormal conclusion because it's easier for them without having to worry about explaining themselves or having to try to understand the mysteries of the world? It's just like, oh, here's something I can't explain, let's make it paranormal so I don't got to worry about it and no more research. It can't be explained.
Yeah, in some ways. And I think the other way is we've got this glut of mostly not very good paranormal programs now, all over the shop. I mean, some of them are great and some of them are just awful. And we've got loads of things being uploaded to YouTube and various social media. So we've got this glut of stuff. So the first thing everybody goes to is paranormal rather than trying to look at it with a cooler head.
Right.
For instance, the Loch Ness Monster. It's more likely to be Elvis Presley in a rubber suit than it is to be a plesiosaur. If the Loch Ness Monster exists and things like it, then it's some sort of fish. It's a huge catfish, a huge sturgeon, or perhaps most interestingly, an absolutely gigantic eel. That's the only things that makes biological sense. And most of the film and photographs we see purporting to be a Loch Ness monster are boat wakes or pieces of debris being pulled by undercurrents in the loch or water birds. Because people go up there with the notion of the monster in their mind. So anything odd on the water becomes a monster. If you were looking at another lake, you might not think twice about it.
All right, Richard. Well, it's about that time where we usually let our guests go. So the mic is all yours to tell everybody where they can find the book and find you.
Well, the book, this is it, In Search of Real Monsters. It's actually a second volume. It's from Mango Publications. The first volume is called Adventures in Cryptozoology. But the book was too long, so they had to cut it into two. This is the second volume. First one, Adventures in Cryptozoology. The second one, In Search of Real Monsters. So you can get that online. You go to Amazon, you'll find it. You could probably find it in most good bookshops and probably most rubbish bookshops as well. If you want to contact me, my email is dr3uk@yahoo.com. And the Centre for 14 Zoology, our website is www.cfz.org.uk, or just type in Centre for 14 Zoology and you'll get it.
All right, Richard Freeman, thank you for being on Paratruth Radio.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, that was Richard Freeman, author of In Search of Real Monsters, Book 2 in Adventures in Cryptozoology. Definitely a very interesting read. I highly recommend it to anybody who's super interested into cryptozoology and, more to the point, classic cryptozoology compared to the cryptozoology we see today. And we could probably get more into that. But first, we're going to go to Eric's Random Fact of the Day, a quick commercial, and we'll be right back with Paratruth Radio.
Now, Eric's Random Fact of the Day.
Did you know that nutmeg can be fatally poisonous? According to bestlifeonline.com, a small dash of nutmeg in a pumpkin pie or on your eggnog can give it some extra flavor and a lovely spicy scent. However, too much nutmeg can actually be toxic. In fact, 2 to 3 teaspoons of raw nutmeg can induce hallucinations, convulsions, pain, nausea, and paranoia that can last for several days. Actual fatalities are rare, but they have happened.
This was Eric's Random Fact of the Day.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Paratruth Radio. As always, my name is Eric.
And I'm Justin.
And we just recently got off the line with Richard Freeman. He is the author of In Search of Real Monsters. And before we went to break, Justin, you had said we could probably get into a little bit more of that regarding the classical cryptozoology compared to the, I guess we'll call it the modern cryptos. And we're not talking about cryptocurrency. This is zoology, different cryptos. It's interesting because growing up, despite the fact that, you know, people like you and I, I grew up always believing in, or at least acknowledging things like the werewolf and the Bigfoot, mm-hmm. you know, those type of creatures, a chupacabra. But growing up, it was primarily always on my mind about the classical cryptos. So things like the Tasmanian tiger, for example, or wolf, if you will. They're creatures that I often did research on in middle school and high school. And it was things that was talked about regularly in science class and various things like that. But as we have come further into modern times, we've kind of, at least in the paranormal community, we've kind of stepped away from the classic cryptozoology and started moving into the modern, where our main focus is on these creatures that can't really be explained by science. It's much more paranormal in many ways. And that, again, going everything from the dog man, the Bigfoot, broad term, mm-hmm. I think, for all the various types of big feats. Is that right? Bigfoots? Big feet? I would big think, foots. You know. and all those other fantastical creatures. But, I mean, what do you think is the main or was the main change from the classical cryptid zoology to the modern?
Richard Freeman brought it up. I mean, today we're going into it thinking paranormal. And back then, cryptozoology was all about explaining, finding creatures that are supposed to be extinct or not existent anymore. And we're actually seeing more of that now today than we have in the past. Now, granted, we are in a very digital age where information can be found more freely than it used to be. But I think we really are finding more creatures that are supposed to be quote unquote extinct. And that's what cryptozoology really was all about. I didn't bring it up when it was on, but the thylacine was by far the most interesting creature to me when I was looking at cryptozoology or looking at cryptozoological books, because it is, first off, it's just a very odd creature to look at, especially because the way the mouth opens and closes, it's just odd. But after a while, you know, we started getting into the YouTube era and stuff like that, and seeing videos that were caught on normal, you know, video recorders, video cameras, and someone, I don't know how long ago it was I saw this video, but I had seen a video that was taken on a regular video camera, tapes, all that stuff for you millennials out there that won't remember this or past millennials, and it caught a full-on side and front view of something that I couldn't explain anything more than a thylacine. The mouth opened the way that supposedly this creature did. It had the striping. It moved the way that they say the thylacine did. So this was one that always fascinated me, and I do agree with Richard that unfortunately now we jump to the paranormal, and that should be the last thing that we think about. And you and I have talked about this numerous times when we talk about paranormal investigations. Rule out all of the natural stuff before you say this is something paranormal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree, especially when it comes to creatures like this, which are at least supposed to be a lot less spiritual and more physical, in presence, and I think it is interesting that, and again, it could, like you said, it could be the technology nowadays that we have, but we are seeing more and more creatures, that we thought were extinct popping up in random locations, and this is an ongoing thing, especially in the oceans. I mean, years ago, it was only 10% of the oceans that were explored. I don't know if that's changed at all. Maybe we're at 11% or 10.5%. I have no idea. You would think after like 10 years, we'd be a little further along. But
well, did you see an art? Not to cut you off, but did you see an article that they've found an area that's deeper than the Mariana Trench?
I don't think I did see that.
Yeah, again, it was on Facebook. Of course, I didn't save it, but they've found an area in the ocean that's deeper than the trench.
That's creepy. I mean, the ocean scares me to begin with, just the depths, mm-hmm. and who knows what's living down there. But you know what?
And yet you love surfing.
I know. Well, I love the ocean, though. It's what do you call it? It's a paradox.
It's a love-hate relationship.
I'm scared to death of it, but I love it at the same time. Here, I have a healthy respect of it. How about that? I have a healthy respect of the ocean and the creatures within it. But anyway, you know, just a few days ago, I actually saw an article, and I forget where it was. I think it was somewhere on the East Coast, where a kid actually came across, he happened to find a megalodon tooth. Now, the thing that's interesting about megalodon teeth is that if they've been extinct for as long as they've been extinct, they really should not be washing up on shore. Or if they have, they should all be washed up by now. And yet they continuously wash up on shore for some reason. Is it possible that there's fault line, you know, the fault lines in the ocean, they shift and it kicks up this dust and it get, you know, a tooth gets caught in a current and is, you know, ends up on the beach? Maybe, possibly. I don't know. Or, I mean, Mariana Trench is deep enough. Now there's a place that's even deeper. Who knows if these creatures are still living and where they could be hiding. I mean, they might be very, very deep in the water, especially something that size. And of course, considering how large the oceans are on this planet, I wouldn't doubt that something's out there. But it just doesn't make sense to me why these fossils are still washing up on shore after supposedly millions of years of extinction.
Right. So question for you. Do you think that if it ever, this is just kind of a apocalypse type of scenario where the polar caps completely melt, kind of like in Waterworld, do you think we would end up fighting for our lives more than we do now with nature?
I don't know. Not necessarily. It depends. I guess it depends on how much land is left. Because I mean, if you're saying that we're pretty much on an Earth that's just water, primarily, which I mean, obviously it is not primarily water anyway. But
right.
If you're talking about where there's basically no land, well then that's a significant amount of animals that are going to go extinct, because our land mammals and animals can't survive in water. They'd eventually drown. So I think the only thing that changes really is how we deal with the type of animals or creatures that are existing around us at the time. The ocean is vastly different, because humans being land mammals just aren't really meant to be out in the water. It's, you know, when you go out in the ocean, you're not at the top of the food chain anymore. You know, there's no, you know, unless you're on a boat or something, maybe, but otherwise you're just kind of, you know, victim to nature and hope that nature, you know, sides kindly with you. I don't know if there would be a big struggle against various animals, but I think just generally speaking, it'd be a much greater struggle. It'd be a change for sure. A lot of things would have to change.
Okay, fair enough. All right, any final thoughts on cryptids in general or the book In Search of Real Monsters?
Not so much. Just another interesting topic that kind of brought a lot of the memories, you know, the past to the forefront here. Again, talking about that Tasmanian tiger is something that's been years, you know, that I've done any research on. And some of these other creatures too. You know, I think this has opened up, this book in general has opened up kind of a pathway, I guess, into going back into some of that old research that I've done and seeing what creatures exactly have appeared over the last 10 years that I didn't even know about.
Right. All right. Well, that wraps up In Search of Real Monsters from Richard Freeman. Again, make sure you check out the book. It was very interesting to read through his adventures and see the different creatures that he's researched. Like I said to Richard, I was super excited to see that he had actually done boots on the ground research on the Mongolian death worm. Eric and I are talking about doing boots on the ground research on the Devil's Lake monster while he's here in July. So look forward to that. Next week, we are going to be talking to Lady Anne, who identifies as a vampire, and she's also a witch. So it'll be super fascinating to talk about her life and experiences with all that. And we got a lot of other great stuff coming for you guys. We got some more down the rabbit holes coming for you. Eric and I are going to kind of start staggering back and forth between guests and the down the rabbit holes or episodes of just him and I. So a lot of great stuff coming for you guys. Make sure you check out Evergreen Podcasts and killerpodcast.com, where we now reside for the most part, but you can find us on all of the social medias, all of the podcatchers, and of course on paratruth.com, where you can leave us a voicemail or just comment on stuff on episodes, or just contact us through the website or any of our other areas. But until next week, folks, where you will find us same time, same channel. My name is Justin.
And I'm Eric. Peace.
Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon!